Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for Monday, August the 30th, 2021. This is Air Force veteran David Corey, along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Our special guest this evening is Megan Brooks, who teaches at Yale Law School and who is one of the leaders of Yale Law School's Veterans Legal Services Clinic. The clinic has done remarkable work over the past decade on many veteran issues. Megan will tell us about the Yale Veterans Legal Services Clinic and its projects. But before introducing her, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you? Good evening, Megan. It's great to have you on our show tonight. Before we get to Megan, I want to remind everybody that this is a call-in show. And we welcome all our listeners to call in and tell us what's going on in the VA world, but maybe something to do with your benefits or troubles that you're having at the VA or the Board of Veteran Appeals. But give us a call. We're here to listen. Our number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, that number is 1-888-627-6008. Our guest tonight, Megan, has some interesting things to tell us about what she does with veterans. So maybe you want to call in and talk to Megan. So again, give us a call at 1-888-627-6008. All right, David, let's get on with the show. And Megan Brooks.
Megan Brooks is a faculty member and lawyer at Yale Law School's Veteran Legal Services Clinic. She is a clinical lecturer in law, associate research scholar in law, and clinical teaching fellow at Yale Law School. Previously, she worked with the Special Litigation Unit and the Public Benefits Unit, units of Veterans Practice at New York Legal Assistance Group, where she handled veterans benefits appeals and worked to advance pro-veteran policy. Her law degree is from Yale Law School, and her undergraduate degree is from Harvard. So let's welcome Megan Brooks to the Veterans News Hour. Hi, Megan. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, it's our privilege that you can join us. Thank you so much. I know there's so much we can talk about as far as veteran issues. Let me just start by asking you to tell us really about the role of legal clinics in general, but also including Yale Law School's Veteran Legal Services Clinic. What do clinics do, and what's the role played by law students?
Absolutely. So to give you a little bit of background about legal clinics generally, law school clinics, and also specifically Veterans Legal Services Clinics, they have two main goals. So the first goal would be to teach young lawyers. So law students who don't yet have their degrees, don't yet have their bar licenses, just like how in medical school a doctor is going to go through shadowing and then training programs and residency and all of those things before they can finally become actual doctors. So too in legal education, the Legal Academy has made the determination that law students should also be getting hands-on practical experience in the law before they get their degree. And so that's goal number one. But goal number two, and this is really why veterans law clinics came into the space, is we want to provide services. We want to provide services to, you know, the communities at large, but also specifically to the communities that our law schools are located in. And different clinics will all have different missions, they'll all have some sort of variation of that, but that's generally the idea behind them. And so to that end, veterans legal clinics in law schools really started springing up really in the past decade and a half. They're newer. Law clinics themselves in law schools are not that new. They've been around since at least the 60s, and it's become more and more prolific and are now essentially a requirement for accreditation at American law schools. But the veterans law clinics came a little bit later on the scene, and that's due, I think, to two reasons, one of which is a good reason and one of which is not so good of a reason. So the first reason would be that you know, veterans law as a discipline that a large number of attorneys practice didn't really come into its own until the creation of the Veterans Court in the late 80s. And so as a result, you know, the whole veterans bar to a certain degree is a fairly young bar in the case law, because the Veterans Court, the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, is a fairly young court. It took some time to sort of build up the kind of appellate practice that really drew in a lot of attorneys. The second reason is that I think a lot of law schools were under the misapprehension that veterans law is kind of rote, you know, perhaps a little bit boring, or just doing the same type of claim over and over again. We know, those of us who practice, that is far from the case. Not only is it tremendously important for the people that we serve, not just for veterans, but for their family members, we also know that it's interesting. It's exciting. There's all kinds of new and exciting legal developments happening in the field. And for that reason, veterans clinics at law schools have really proliferated over the last decade. They're springing up everywhere. There's quite a growing community of veterans law clinicians. There's a consortium, actually, that's run by some really good folks who do fantastic policy and advocacy work, in addition to advancing clinical teaching scholarship on behalf of veterans law. It's really an exciting field, and that's how the clinic came in. The clinic was started at Yale Law School about 10 years ago by Professor Mike Wishney. Mike came to the clinic out of a sort of workers' rights background. That was really, he did a bit of housing law before that. He did a bit of immigration. But he really came out of the sort of tradition that wants to organize people, wants to get people the benefits they deserve, wants to improve their quality of life. And he saw so many parallels in the veterans world, where, you know, fundamentally the veterans benefits that you're getting are a form of employment benefit, right? You sign up to serve. In a lot of ways, you know, the call to serve goes beyond a typical job. And in so many ways, it's all encompassing. It's a higher cause and all of that. But in a lot of ways, it is a job that has certain promises made to you when you sign that contract. And a lot of what we do is try to enforce those rights and enforce those benefit promises. And so that's kind of how we came onto the scene, to give you the long and the short of it.
Right. Well, that's great background. Can you tell us about some of Yale's work on behalf of veterans and veteran issues, including through the use of something I've been really impressed with your work, which is the use of class action cases?
Absolutely. So in the clinic, we really focus on a wide range of work. We're more of a population-focused clinic than we are a, you know, type of law-focused clinic. So we do a lot of disability benefits applications and appeals. That's a huge part of our work. All of our incoming students will do in their first semester either a disability benefits case or a discharge upgrade, most typically. But then, because we're population focused, we're asking ourselves, what do the veterans in our community need? What do the veterans in New Haven need? What do they need in Connecticut? What do they need nationally? And so to that end, we try to think creatively as well. And so that's led us to litigation against the service academies, in some respects, to try to overturn the Ferris Doctrine, which prevents service members from suing in tort, right, which is like your medical malpractice or your sexual right. assault claim or something like that. We've also brought two nationwide class actions against the discharge review boards, which are not within VA. Those are within the Department of Defense. And what we've been really expanding on in the past, I'm going to get, what year is it, the past seven-ish years, we and many other advocates, so it's not just us, it's National Veterans Legal Services Program, the Harvard Clinic, some private firms have all been involved in this effort to take the class action mechanism that we know delivers justice efficiently, effectively, and fairly to groups of people who've all been harmed similarly in the, you know, federal courts and in the state courts and in the non-VA systems, we've been trying to bring that mechanism into the VA, because there's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to do it in VA. Where there's a common legal question, it would seem to make sense to sort of resolve the question on a class basis for everyone involved. And so to that end, the clinic filed and litigated all the way up to the federal circuit a case called Monk. At various times, Monk v. Wilkie, Monk v. McDonough, went through a whole bunch of secretaries. But in Monk, for the first time since the early 90s, really, the clinic put to Mr. Monk and his class members put to the CABC, you know, we've all of us, been waiting on average 6 years to get our cases heard at the Board of Veterans Appeals. That's a common harm. It should be solved through a common solution. They lost at the CAVC. First off, the CAVC said absolutely not. They pointed to a case they had done in the early 90s that said, no, we're not going to do class actions. The clinic appealed up to the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit said, actually, there's nothing in your authorizing statute. There's nothing in the Constitution. There's nothing anywhere that says that you cannot do these. In fact, you can do these. And then the case went back to the CAVC, and the Veterans Court said, all right, we are going to do these. They declined to certify the class in Monk. The class lost on commonality grounds. The court thought that at the end of the day, the reasons why everyone's claims were being delayed at the board or their appeals were being delayed were not the same reason. And so we lost on commonality grounds. But that was kind of the watershed moment where the Federal Circuit said, yes, you can hear class actions. The Veterans Court said, okay, yes, we will. And since then, there have been four class actions certified. So two are in, or three are in a writ posture, which is sort of where you don't go through the traditional appeal system, but you say to the court, there's something wonky happening here. We're being prevented from getting to you. Like, something's happening down below that's really preventing us from taking our rightful place in your court and letting you hear our arguments. And the fourth, and the clinic is not involved in any of those cases. The fourth, though, is SCAR. It's spelled S-K-A-A-R, but Victor SCAR, the named representative, he pronounces it in the Norwegian way. SCAR is the very first case that was certified by the CAVC from an appeals case. So it worked its way up the ladder, just like any other benefits appeal. He lost the Board of Veterans Appeals, and so filed his appeal at the Veterans Court, and the Veterans Court certified the class after much argument. That's currently on appeal again at the Federal Circuit, but that's where we are, and we're hoping that the Veterans Court will continue to see the class action as just a really useful and effective tool to resolve these common questions that are popping up in case after case after case.
Well, that's great, Megan. I want to really follow up with two questions to what you were describing about class actions, and I'm not sure which of these you prefer to discuss first. But my two questions are the SCAR case, if I recall correctly, deals with the Palomares, Spain nuclear disaster. I think, is that correct?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so what I would want to do, the first question would be ask you to tell us more about that case, because I think it's fascinating. I only a few months ago learned about that. But the other question I have is, when you're talking about class actions, anything you can share with us about the idea of, or the development, or where things are at with getting class actions addressed below the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, below the CAVC, mm-hmm. but at the Board of Veterans Appeals. So those are really my two follow-up questions, if you want to tackle either one of them or whatever order.
Sure, and actually I can tackle them together because the clinic actually filed what we believe might be the first ever request for a class action or aggregate action at the Board of Veterans Appeals earlier this summer, and that was also about Palomares. So to sort of, to sort of give a little bit of background about Palomares itself and then get into the board and our request for a board class action. In 1966, January 17th, a B-52 bomber collided with a refueling plane midair. And these were Cold War days, and the U.S. was essentially scrambling jets over Europe for much of the Cold War that were carrying nuclear bombs, so hydrogen bombs, in case something needed to, you know, in case the nuclear football got thrown or whatever the term might be, that they were ready to go. So these two collide. The four bombs, you know, come crashing down to Earth. Thankfully, they were not armed. They were in the off position. One plunged into the Mediterranean. It was one of the like very first deep sea submersible rescues that occurred. It was a huge technological marvel. But the other three landed in this little farming village. Their biggest crop was tomatoes, and it's, you know, the seaside pastoral village, super tiny. Two of them conventionally detonated, so they didn't go through the nuclear chain reaction that would have, you know, wiped a lot of southern Spain off the face of the map, but they did eventually detonate. And so those plutonium cores cracked, and they shot plutonium dust over the countryside. And then the very next day, there were at that time some Air Force bases, U.S. Air Force bases in Spain. And so those airmen, along with a smattering of sailors and soldiers, were deployed down to Palomares, where they were essentially given shovels and told to clean up the plutonium. And, you know, they didn't have masks, they didn't have gloves. They eventually did get some masks, but they were, you know, the flimsy paper ones. And service members, airmen, slept within, you know, 50 feet of one of the impact craters. They ate the produce that was all around the field because the U.S. government bought it off the Spanish government because the crop was ruined. And as one might expect, this is a population of veterans who are likelier, it appears, to develop cancers, radiogenic cancers and other radiogenic illnesses, meaning illnesses caused by radiation, than their peers. Despite this, you know, DOD, Department of Defense, maintains that no one was exposed to enough radiation to cause anything serious. VA has refused to recognize Palomares. Congress passed a law that lets VA add to sort of a list of presumptive radiation risk activities certain events. And so under this regulation, which is 38 CFR 3309, if you have one of the medical conditions that's listed on the regulation, and if you were at one of the events that's listed in the regulation, you're going to get presumptive service connection for your condition. Palomares is not on that list, and that's despite that there are at least three other events where we know that service members were exposed to less radiation than they were exposed to at Palomares.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's arbitrary and capricious. It's an equal protection violation. It's all of those different things. And so what's happening instead is, you know, you don't fall under 309, which is the presumptive service connection. So they kick you to 311, which is a different regulation that says that, okay, if you don't get presumptive service connection, we're going to do some science. We're going to run you through a dose estimate equation, and we're going to try to figure out the probability that your medical condition was caused by radiation or by your exposure in service. And the SCORE case is about that equation. It's about that science. We have a he's a MacArthur Genius Grant winning nuclear physicist who has reviewed the methodology that's currently being used. And it said, you know, it's junk. It's not scientific. It does not adhere to VA's own requirement that these calculations be based on sound scientific evidence. And so that's what the SCORE case is about. Mr. SCORE had also tried to challenge Palomares' exclusion from 309, which is that presumptive service connection regulation. But the CAVC held that he didn't have standing because he doesn't have one of the conditions that's already in the regulation. And so therefore, the CAVC said, actually, you're not harmed by this because even if we were to add Palomares, you know, you still don't have a condition. So therefore, you can't bring that in the suit. However, there are Palomares veterans who do have conditions listed under the regulation. And that's what our new request at the board is. Our new request is a veteran named Edward Feely. Like Mr. Score, he cleaned up the plutonium dust at Palomares in 66. Like Mr. Score, he has radiogenic conditions. He's actually a member of the Score class. But he also has a condition that's listed on 309, and he was recently denied service connection by the VA under both 309 and 311. And so he has asked that the board hear his challenge to the exclusion of Palomares from 309, not just on his behalf, but on behalf of everyone in a similar situation. And, you know, were this to be resolved, right, it would solve the question of service connection in all of the Palomares veterans cases who are at the BVA level or below. And so obviously that's more efficient, right? Like, obviously, right. Obviously that's more fair. Obviously that's gonna get the VA to a place where it's sort of returning the same result to the same group of veterans who've all been injured in the same way.
Let me ask you if I could, Megan. Sure. What was the name of that second veteran, Edward, what was his last name?
Feely.
Okay. And where is his? Where do things stand with his case at this point?
So we have asked the board to hear his challenge of the exclusion of Palomares from the regulation on an aggregate basis. We've asked the board to hear it on a class basis. The board has not gotten back to us. It has been, at this point, let me do some math, over 2 months, and we have not heard back. So we are hopeful that that just means that they're working hard on it. We're fearful that that means that they just don't know what to do with it.
right.
We're gonna have to see where we go from here. You know, Mr. Feely is older. He's over the age of 75, like most of the Palomares veterans, right? Because this event happened in 66. And so, you know, he is entitled to advancement on the docket by the very fact of his advanced age. And so we're expecting to hear from the board, and we will be doing what we can to make sure that the board hears us loud and clear.
Wow, that's awesome. Megan, what are some of the other projects and cases that the clinic is handling, and basically anything else you'd like to share with us about the clinic?
Sure. So we handle a wide variety of cases and matters. I'm trying to remember what on our docket is currently confidential and not.
All right.
Among the cases that we're handling, we do have two nationwide certified class actions in the District of Connecticut. One is against the Army Discharge Review Board. One is against the Navy Discharge Review Board. As you all may be familiar, it has long been the case, and, you know, the Congressional Government Accountability Office has found this in reports, various studies have found this, that service members who experience post-traumatic stress disorder, a traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma, or another mental health condition in service are far likelier than their peers to be discharged, the less than honorable discharge. And oftentimes, you know, the behavior that led to the discharge can be directly tied to the very mental health condition that was caused by the service, right? So
right.
We know that symptoms of PTSD, traumatic brain injury, can include high volatility, which can lead to fighting or that sort of thing. Or we know that a lot of folks will self-medicate, you know, they'll drink to try to numb the pain or they'll do something along those lines, which can also lead to a behavior that leads to a less than honorable discharge and the person's inability to get the benefits that they deserve. And so what's interesting is that the Department of Defense has actually recognized this. And so they've put out a series of memoranda over the last decade that have instructed the discharge review boards and the boards of correction for military records to to give liberal consideration to cases where this arises. So when someone comes in and they say, yes, this happened, yes, I was discharged less than honorably, but, you know, it was due in whole or in part to the symptoms of my PTSD or my traumatic brain injury, or, you know, like, I wouldn't have gone AWOL if it didn't happen to be that, you know, my rapist worked in the same unit as I did and I wasn't getting transferred, right? You know,
right.
Liberal consideration is owed to these veterans. And so they're supposed to be given a second look and a closer look and be more liberally considered for that discharge upgrade. With clinic found rampant evidence that this was just not happening. And so we sued. And we settled with the Army. The case was called Kennedy. And so for folks who were discharged after 2001, who have one of these conditions, they're probably a member of the Kennedy class and are probably entitled to reconsideration of their, if they were denied at the DRB. Manker, which is the Navy counterpart, it's a different case, but that case is Manker and it's for the Navy, is also currently in settlement. We don't know precisely what's going to happen because the settlement hasn't been filed with the court yet and hasn't been finalized, but we would expect something fairly similar.
Let me ask you, Megan, because both of those cases deal with, as I understand it, Iraq and Afghanistan era, in other words, the post 9/11 generation, which certainly, you know, it certainly warrants the attention.
Mm-hmm.
Any thought about the earlier generations as well? Because just in my perception, as insensitive as DOD and its components have historically been towards PTSD, military sexual trauma, and psychological effects, in the last 20 years, the awareness level is certainly much higher than it was 30, 50, 70 years ago. Am I missing anything here? Is this any thoughts on this, or, you know, about the application to earlier generations as well? And, you know, my perception with all these boards, the discharge review boards and the boards for correction, my perception over many years has been that they're really horrible audiences for veterans in general. I do realize they grant relief in some cases, but it's a very difficult task to prevail. They tend to rubber stamp what was already done. Their level of analysis isn't even thorough enough to be called superficial. I mean, that's how bad it is, in my opinion. Any thoughts on this?
So, a few thoughts. So, first, we are hopeful that at, you know, the Army Discharge Review Board, at least, where the settlement is in effect, and hopefully soon at the Navy Discharge Review Board, we are hopeful that we'll start to see some serious improvements for both. But, you know, that leaves the Air Force DRB, it leaves the Coast Guard, and it also leaves the boards, which, as you know, the boards have the ability to, statutorily, the boards have the ability to correct records from the past, for people who've been discharged in the past 3 years. But the Secretary of the Department of Defense, through a memo called the Carson Memo, said that sort of three-year statute of limitations rule will be liberally waived for a whole bunch of folks who are coming in later. And the liberal consideration applies to them as well. We're hopeful that they'll take heed of what we've done in the Kennedy and Manker cases, and we're hopeful that they will start to implement some of the reforms that the Kennedy settlement has implemented in the Army DRB, and the Manker settlement will hopefully implement in the Navy DRB. But who knows? Maybe we will have to sue them too, right?
Right.
Maybe we will.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you know, Yale Law School is behind it, because you all bring a lot of legal power to these actions, and I appreciate that. I've dealt on and off over many years with these boards, and when I was on active duty, my last active duty job in Washington as an Air Force JAG, I worked in a division that provided advisory opinions to the Air Force boards on military justice matters, and it was at that point when I started realizing, you know, what a tough audience it is for these veterans, service members too, that are trying to seek relief through these boards. I think they're just horrible in terms of just rubber stamping things. I mean, many people think that the VA, you know, makes short shrift of things and is superficial in their analysis, but they're relatively speaking far more thorough than these boards are. And as far as a 3-year statute of limitation, you know, for the boards for correction, yes, they can waive that, and you know, to their credit, I think in a lot of cases where they find that there is merit, they will waive it. But I think there's this big concern because PTSD, different names or different wars for it, but you know, it's always been with the military, and I would think that there's a lot of Vietnam vets that are still out there. You know, they may be in their 70s or 80s, but that are in this category, you know, and there's so many homeless veterans out there not eligible or not eligible for much because they had bad paper. So I think this is huge. The Kennedy versus McCarthy settlement, that's a really big deal, and hopefully, as you say, the Navy Marine Corps vets will also benefit. So, okay.
Absolutely.
So, well, I appreciate all this, and I know I think my co-host Rick Hurley may have, some additional questions. Rick, you there?
Yeah. I've been Megan. Let me ask you some questions about the clinic itself.
Sure.
How many students do you have in the clinic?
We have about 30.
That's awesome. And is it a clinic that runs for the full year for the students, or they do half a year?
So students are only required to commit to one semester. So we have our introductory clinic, which is where we really teach the nuts and bolts, not just of VA law and discharge upgrade law, but also of lawyering. So you know, the class tomorrow that we'll teach is focused on client interviewing, for example, as a skill. But Yale is unlike a lot of law schools in that it permits students just kind of park themselves in the clinic and stay for as long as they'd like, which is really fantastic because you do have students who develop a really strong passion for this kind of law, for this population. You know, very few students go on to practice in the field. It's a pretty narrow field. But we hope and we know that students who go on to practice in something else might do their pro bono in veterans work after they graduate, which is always hugely appreciated. Go ahead.
Yeah, you read my mind. I was wondering, from the students who participate in the clinic, how many do you think percentage-wise go off into doing some sort of VA law, either for, you know, as their you know, livelihood versus pro bono?
Right. I think it's a small number. So the clinic's been around for a little over a decade. I would say there are probably less than a dozen of us who've gone on to practice veterans law in some capacity, full time or even part time. However, the number of alums who will continue to do veterans work is huge. We're always litigating. We're always looking for amicus briefs and the like, and you know, just this summer, there are, I'm trying to count, I believe two or three students from my class alone. I went to Yale Law School when I was a student, and I was in the veterans clinic for 2.5 years. There are two or three students from, you know, my time in the clinic alone who are, you know, lawyers out in the world practicing in other fields who we've either approached for assistance or who are actively assisting. So it's just fantastic to see people continue to focus on veterans work in their pro bono, even if they can't devote their whole time to it.
That's awesome. I went to Seton Hall Law Center. I was involved with the clinics, one major clinic there for about 2 years, we used to go into the Metropolitan Correctional Center like twice a week,
mm-hmm.
and dealing with prisoners' rights, and that was just awesome stuff.
So
I'm a big fan of the clinics. I'm on the advisory board at Seton Hall Law Center, and we're in the process of doing all sorts of pretty neat things for veterans, which is more along getting them accepted to the university, to the law school, and then helping them when they graduate to try to find jobs. But one of the projects that I'm working on with Professor Olivia is to try to set up a veterans law clinic. And she came from the West Virginia law clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's been kind of, I gotta admit, it's been kind of hard to get them to go that route on the clinic. And I was just wondering, you know, what tips could you offer in terms of the benefit to the school? Because I think it's not just the benefit to the students, but it's the benefit to the school to have these clinics. What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, I have so many thoughts. The reason I was so enthusiastic when you said Seton Hall is one of our, like, just all-star interns. He is a Seton Hall Evening Division student, and so he actually has come back to the clinic for 3 summers. He's an Army vet, because in the summers we invite students from other law schools to come work in the clinic, because even though our students go off to do other things in the summer, the cases don't stop. So he's at Seton Hall. He's an Army vet, and he plans to do veterans work afterwards. So I'm so glad to hear about the Seton Hall connection. But I think that there are so many reasons to do it. So first, it's an underserved field. It's an area where there are not enough attorneys for the amount of work that there is. People can, you know, go in an initial claim with a VSO, with a veteran service organization. They might even be able to appeal a little bit on their own or with a VSO. But once you kind of get into any level of complexity or any area where the answer is less than black and white, having a lawyer really helps. It's sort of a Byzantine network of rules and regulations, and it's an area where students can quickly get up to speed and can quickly make a real difference in veterans' lives and in veterans' families' lives. And so, you know, the amount of, the extent to which the students get up to speed is just, like, exponential in terms of the amount of positive effect it gives to a client's life. And so that's incredibly rewarding for students, and it's also really beneficial to the community that the law school serves in. In addition to that, in the veterans field, you're going to encounter so many of the same issues, or not the same issues, but you'll encounter so many issues that you would encounter in other areas of the law as well and more, because, again, it's a population-focused thing. So in our clinic, you know, we're doing disability rights. We're doing a little bit of housing. We're doing some education benefits. We're doing some healthcare-adjacent stuff. We're doing race discrimination and gender discrimination and sexual orientation discrimination claims. We're doing FOIA. You know, a large part of our practice is trying to uncover data from the Department of Defense or Department of Veterans Affairs that is going to enable us to shed light on some of the, and enable our clients to shed light on some of the, you know, practices that are preventing veterans from accessing the benefits that they deserve or the like. It really just offers an opportunity for students to do a wide variety of different types of law. And then in terms of working with VA directly, I think that it, and this is a little bit maybe controversial or tricky to say, but in some ways the fact that the veteran has the benefit of the doubt makes mm-hmm. it a little bit less intimidating for law students to get involved. It makes them feel a little bit more confident in their ability to take ownership of a case, because they know that, you know, even though they're going to end up making a huge difference for this veteran, the fact that the veteran has the benefit of the doubt, the fact that, you know, it's pretty hard to close a case permanently, right? Like you can keep appealing as long as you have new and relevant evidence. It makes it an environment where a student can really take ownership over a case, make a huge difference, make a huge impact, and get to touch on all different interesting aspects of the law as well.
One other question. Do you have any of your former law students who are currently working at the Board of Veteran Appeals?
Oh, my goodness. No, I do not.
Oh. Wouldn't that be nice?
I know. I have a friend of a friend who's a VLJ. He's not a VLJ. He works for a VLJ. He's one of the staff attorneys. And we were going to catch up, and the second I said, oh, right, I sue VA, all of a sudden he stopped responding to my emails. But yeah, it's funny how that works.
Wow.
That's not good. Are you familiar with the Stetson Law Clinic?
Which law clinic?
Stetson Law Center? Yeah.
Yes. Professor Stacy Ray Simcox, who runs it, is a force. She's a giant in the field of veterans legal clinics, for sure.
Yeah, they do really good work down there.
They do.
Well, Rick does a lot of I don't know what the COVID, but Rick, you used to do a lot of the moot court judging with them, didn't you?
Yeah, I do their appellate moot court competition every year.
Yeah, yeah.
Down at Stetson Law Center.
Yeah. It's been back about 20 years ago. I taught once a year. They had me teach as an adjunct course in Uniform Code of Military Justice at Stetson. I did that for 4 years, just one class a year. It was pretty interesting. But then they got one or more former JAGs joined as full-time professors. So that was the end of my need. But it was fun, a lot of fun. But anyway, so Megan, if I could just—I know we just got a few minutes left. Rick, go ahead if you got some other questions. I just got.
Yeah, Megan, we are getting down the wire here. But what can veterans and veteran groups do to help your clinic?
Oh, that's a great question. I think one of the things that folks can do is, you know, if you live in Connecticut or if you know a veteran or a survivor or a family member who lives in Connecticut and especially in the New Haven area who needs some legal assistance, send them our way. You know, we're a small teaching program, so we can only take a handful of cases each semester, but we love to hear directly from folks in the clinic, from folks in the community as to what sort of legal issues are popping up. And then, you know, you can always follow our work and amplify it. One of the cases that we just filed this summer, the clinic represents Black Veterans Project and National Veterans Center for Legal Redress, which is a New Haven-based veterans advocacy organization, in a series of FOIAs and Freedom of Information Act requests where we requested all kinds of racial disparity data from VA about, you know, the breakdown of who's getting benefits and who's not. There's a lot of scholarship and evidence showing that in the distribution of the original GI Bill benefits, for example, there were huge racial disparities, but the data's kind of dried up in recent decades. And so we filed suit there, that we got quite a bit of news coverage, and it's really that news coverage, more so than the suit in a lot of ways, that compels VA to be more transparent, compels VA to really shed light on its practices so that people can understand what's going on and they can have more trust in VA in general. And so to the extent that folks can amplify the work like that that's coming out of the clinic, and not just our clinic, but, you know, all kinds of veterans clinics around the country, that's always hugely appreciated.
And what's the best way for them to reach you?
So they can go to our website. So if you Google Yale Law School and Veterans Legal Services Clinic, you will come up with our site where you can take a look at our press releases, our active cases, and also how to contact us. So there's a number on there, there's an email on there, fax, really whatever works best for folks. I wish I had that committed to memory, but I do not.
That's quite all right. Back to you, David.
Well, thanks. Megan, you've covered so much great information for us, and I really want to applaud the work you're doing and everyone at the Yale Legal Services, Veterans Legal Services Clinic. A couple just observations. I think the legal firepower that you bring to this and the law school brings, Yale and the students there, is just wonderful, especially in areas where solo practitioners or even some veteran lawyers just can't make an impact. Those include the class action suits. Those include the Freedom of Information Act litigation, which I think is so important to hold the DOD and the VA accountable on all these issues. Mm-hmm. So thank you for all the work that that you all are doing. We hope that you can join us again as our guest sometime in the future. But before you go, anything else you'd like to share with us?
Man, well, thank you. That was lovely. I don't think that there's much more other than, I got into this work because my dad was in the Army, and then I grew up on veterans benefits. Veterans benefits paid for me to go to college. My brother's active duty now, and I do this work in part to make sure that he's treated well while he's in and treated well when he gets out. And it's really, in terms of who's doing the work, I just supervise. You know, it's the students who are carrying the brunt of the legal load, and it's our clients who are really the ones persevering and pushing forward and making the tough calls to, in some cases, put their name out there publicly and stand to make a difference for people in their shoes. It's really them that do the work. And so it's been such a pleasure to talk about the incredible work that they do, the work that our clients do. I can't wait to hear the rest of the show.
Well, thank you. And please pass on my thanks. And I know Rick shares these thoughts too. Thanks to you and everyone at the clinic, all the students. Great work, and keep up the great work. And hope you can join us again in the future.
Yes, thanks
all right.
Very much, Megan.
Thanks so much. Have a great night.
Take care. Take care, too. Megan.
All right. Bye bye.
Well, thanks again to Megan Brooks from the Yale Law School Veterans Legal Services Clinic. Again, they are working on and have in the past, over the past decade, worked on some really landmark cases, and they're still working them on the class action lawsuit. She just touched on a few of them, but some of the really ones with great impact are like the discharge upgrade ones where she talked about, because hundreds of thousands of veterans are denied VA benefits simply because they were discharged under circumstances that are, you know, traced to the psychological injury that they suffered. So whether it was the Kenny versus McCarthy case or the other cases they're working on, they're really making a big positive impact. And their use of class action lawsuits and Freedom of Information Act lawsuits are just, really important. Rick, before we go to closing, because I know we always like to remind our listeners about the VA's Coaching and Care Program, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just, I was focusing a little bit on the clinic itself. And, clinics are great ways for law students to learn the more practical side of the law when you're attending law school. And, law school can be kind of tedious and boring over time. And when you get into these clinics, it really gives you a hands-on experience, gives you client contact, which, Megan was bringing all this up, the opportunity for these students to deal with, that meeting veterans or families and being able to, form a relationship with these people, with these veterans and their families. Having been a member of a clinic for 2 years myself, I can just imagine how wonderful the experience must be for these students. So I think it's terrific what they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd love to get Seton Hall. You know, I keep bringing it up, and they tend to be focusing on the opportunities for veterans as law students, and then helping them, mentoring them to get into the field of law in whatever field they want to get into. But you know, I keep harping on, you know, it would be great. You know, Seton Hall's right there in Newark, New Jersey, and you know, they've got their own share of veterans in that area, and Seton Hall would be a great, if they had that clinic, would be a great addition to the community.
Absolutely.
You know, which is another thing Megan brought up, you know, the benefit to the community in New Haven. And I'm sure, you know, David, we've talked many times with the people at Stetson. I'm sure the work they're doing in St. Petersburg, there's so many veterans in St. Pete.
Absolutely, yeah.
So work they're doing there. So it's great to see. And, you know, over time, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more veterans law clinics around the country.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, the need is going to be there. You know, so it's good that I think it's good that there is that support. And she mentioned that there's a consortium of law school veteran clinics, and you know, Stetson's one, and Yale's another, but there are others. And perhaps, you know, Seton Hall can look to what some of these other ones are doing, so they don't have to feel like they're starting from scratch and how to develop a program. And I think it probably is going to require at least one faculty member who's really interested and has some insight. But that's maybe where they, you know, a lot of law schools rely on adjuncts for narrow specialties. You know, that's why I was teaching Uniform Code of Military Justice. It was an area that I knew a lot about. But, you know, maybe if they get some adjuncts in there, from practitioners.
Yeah, and Seton Hall has professor. I mentioned this to Megan, Professor Olivia. She was at the West Virginia Law School, and they have a clinic. They have a veterans clinic there. So,
yeah.
So you know, she is the go to person. If they get this clinic set up there, she'll be the person that will get it off the ground.
Well, that's great, and I wish you success with Seton Hall. So I guess we're about out of time here, Rick, if you want to tell us about the Coaching into Care program.
Absolutely. Coaching into Care just helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment. Loved ones can help. The Coaching into Care program helps you help your veteran. That number is 1-888-823-7458. Again, that's 1-888-823-7458. Give the Coaching the Care program a call. It's there from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Help you help your veteran. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, who also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help, that number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they want, that they need. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, that number at the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Well, it's time for us to go. I'd like to thank you all for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Corey and Hurley Law Group, and I thank our producer, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in same time, same station next week for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, stay safe and have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week, when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.